Okay. So, there's my mic. So where to start? The zombies, so to speak, are back together. And that's cool enough, but the new album is getting incredibly positive notices. Oh, you know what we should do first? I'm always improper. Can you sign in, please? Can we have you introduce yourselves? Because I'm already launching into the questions and okay. People who could be answering these questions?
Okay, well, it could be me, Rod Argent.
It could be.
Or it could be me, Colin Blunstein.
Okay, so we have the right people in the room. So that's a start. Now, where was I? It's cool enough that you're back together, but the album is getting incredibly positive notices. Not that that's a surprise, but how does it all feel? I mean, just, you know, you just mentioned that you've just gotten over here and you're getting used to being here and all of that. But I went on the website, and we'll talk a lot about that, and I'm just, okay. It's got to be an amazing feeling to be doing this.
It really is, and one of the most extraordinary things for me is that, you know, for many years, I came off the road when Argent, my second band, finished in 1975, and I thought I'd had enough of live playing for many reasons. Things were very different then, actually. Life on the road was very different then. But anyway, for many reasons, I decided I'd had enough, and I wanted to go into different areas of music, which I did for quite a few years. I thought I'd never be on the road again, and it just sort of happened naturally. I did a charity show for a jazz musician who lives quite close to me, John Dankworth. Mm-hmm. John Dankworth and Claire Lane, who, in fact, I think they've got a home in Sonoma, or is it Sonoma?
Sonoma, yes.
Sonoma, mm-hmm. Yeah, over here, which they live in part of the year. But during that concert, Colin was in the audience. He got up on the spur of the moment, sang a couple of songs with me, and it felt so natural that suddenly we found ourselves back on the road. So it was a very natural thing. And what amazed me was what a buzz it was being back on the road again. And the actual feeling when we're on stage and we've got a great band with us, it's exactly the same as it was when we started out all those years ago. You know, it feels like the years just peel away, and it's an incredibly energising experience. And the actual time on stage is filled with as much energy as it ever was. And it's very revitalising. It feels great.
What about you, Colin? I mean, no, it's an interesting thing because the second that I put this on, I said, the voice is there. The voice. And I don't mean that in a facetious way. I certainly mean that in a respectful and positive way.
It's getting better.
It's been quite interesting for me because when I started back on the road, I'd been to a singing coach quite recently. I mean, I never had any lessons when I in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s.
There was no time for that back then.
No, exactly.
You were too busy, you know, 16 or whatever age it was. You were too busy forming a band and having hits.
That's
why learn how to sing?
I know. But I think as you get older, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people would benefit from a bit of coaching with
that's
their
so
voice.
Admirable that you tell that story.
Oh, well, it just seems very natural to me. And so I try and practice every day. I have a practice tape, and it's made my voice much stronger. And I think it would be very difficult for me now, because our schedule is quite heavy. You know, I mean, we often play every day. And when we play a show, we play for 2 hours.
Wow.
And a lot of our, in fact, in San Francisco, we won't be playing for 2 hours because we're playing with love, and we're very happy to be playing with such a wonderful band. But because there's two bands, we'll be playing roughly half our normal show. Wow. But a lot of our songs are also very rangy, and they really stretch your vocal cords. And it's just a tremendous help that I've had this coaching.
And there are so many voices in the world that couldn't hit those ranges with or without a singing coach, and yet they still try. And I'm not going to mention any current comeback bands, but I'll mention one of them in a reference in a little while. And it's just having seen them recently, and then you hear them doing the, you know, even the old tunes, and you just kind of say, and you're correct, yes, a singing coach might.
it's always been a cross around Colin's net, actually. The very first time I heard him sing, I got very excited because he had such a good range. So I immediately started writing songs
for
the very top of that range.
Every
and the poor
song,
guy.
Yeah.
I mean, we're doing a radio show at 7:30 a.m. live in Los Angeles after the show the previous night. And Colin, you know, has got to sing She's Not There as part of this thing, you know, and he's got to be right at the top of the range at 7:30 in the morning. And he's cursed me from the age of 17 for doing that.
So you put out an album in 2002, but not officially as The Zombies. And Rod, you say in the liner notes, and I did actually take the time to read them, the reason you chose to pick up the band name again is because the songs were all written with, you know, Colin in mind.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so that's why you chose to pick up the moniker of The Zombies again.
We never thought ever about calling ourselves The Zombies. And in fact, we've...
And on the album, you've gone out of your way. It says Colin Blunstone, Rod Argent, The Zombies.
We thought it was important to put our own names on there as well, because this is very much our version of The Zombies, even though to our amazement, we found a lot in our heads, we heard a lot of connections with the early stuff. Now, we're not saying this is exactly like an early Zombies album, but there were many connections, and I think the reason for that was that it took us by surprise. And I've sat back and wondered about this, but I think it was because so many of the same building bricks were in place, because for the first time, the previous album that we did together... It was an album of Colin singing my songs, but none of those songs had been written for Colin specifically. They were songs that were lying around. We were experimenting in the studio. Colin said, it's such a gas on stage, why don't we try recording again? And so we did. But then suddenly we've been together playing for 3 years. We've got a great band in place. And suddenly I find myself writing a selection of songs with Colin's voice in the back of my head, as I say on the liner notes. And within the context of playing within a great band. So suddenly, I'm writing songs for Colin in a band context. And when we were listening to some of the stuff back again from the album, we suddenly thought, listen to that bit of melody, the way that turns around. That could have been something we'd have done, you know, back in 1967. Or listen to those harmonies, you know. Can you hear that? Just think about, you know, I don't know, Changes or something from Odyssey and Oracle. Or... there was one track on there, Time to Move, which came out sounding like... I just wrote it as a quick rock and roll song, and it came out sounding like something we could have put an album in 1965 with a few sound changes.
I'm going to save, because I'm about three questions down on that.
Okay,
one,
sorry.
But, oh,
okay.
No. But yes, but
so for the first time, sure. It felt sort of honest to include The Zombies' name, and it wasn't something we didn't think. Now, you know, we want to make a buck, so we're going to reform The Zombies. It's really not that. It came out of us suddenly being surprised by having such a blast on stage, and suddenly finding ourselves revisiting some of the areas that quite naturally, without trying, that we had in the old days. So for the first time, it felt honest to do that.
And speaking of the old days, it's kind of interesting to me that you're on Rhino, which is known, at least here in the US, which is known as the ultimate reissue label. But for the purpose of getting out there, they are indeed attached to, you know, a major label. So that's
Warner's,
a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Is there any worry on your part that people won't realize this is new music?
I don't think so. I mean, it's you know, I think there are the same problems all over the world now, that radio generally, which is so wonderful to see you outside of this format, but radio generally is categorised so severely that they say, you know, oh, great, The Zombies, we'll play anything you recorded up until 1967, you know. And then other stations, no matter what it sounds like, will say, oh, no, we couldn't possibly program that because you're The Zombies. We, you know, you fit into this category. And that's a real problem. But by the same token, just initially anyway, there's been so much excitement from the record company. It's so great to be hooked up with a record company who loves the album and really wants to find ways of getting it out there. And I guess that's what it's about.
They've got the power to do so, and that's a lovely thing. But it's interesting that you talk about the categories, because the first thing... when I asked for the interview that was asked of me is, what do you know about these gentlemen beyond, and I said, beyond She's Not There, beyond, I said, you know, let me explain to you. Okay, you can have the interview. So it became the qualifier.
Wow.
Was, if you're an oldies station and you're telling me that the only tracks you've ever played by these guys are those, you know, those two or three hits, then it's not going to happen. So, Colin, I'm going to ask both of you this. The name of the album, as far as I can see, ... What comes after the ellipses?
I don't know. I mean, really, it's just taken from a track that's on the album. I mean, we could have come up with a million titles, but we obviously didn't. We copped out and just took a track from the album.
Well, that's absolutely true. But the actual song was written when... Now, this is an interesting connection, because the engineer on our very first recording session, She's Not There... it was his very first session, and he went on to become one of the most famous producers in the world. That was Gus Dudgeon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Gus died he was in fantastic shape, mentally, physically, you know, in every other way, still listened to loads of new music, was involved with new bands, etc. And he and his wife died in a car crash. It was very, very sad. We were at the funeral, and the vicar gave an address, you know, like a funeral address. And he and it was just something he said that, that made me come up with that song, because he was basically talking about, you know, we can only see so far. You know, Gus had everything going for him, and but, you know, basically our life is so fragile that, that that these things can come along at any minute. And really, that was the birth of that song, as far as I can see. And then it seemed to be, to both of us, you know, a good generic title for the album, because we didn't plan this. This wasn't a contrived, you know, formula. This is just something that happened. And we can really, all of us can only see so far in the future, and we're just riding with something that gives us pleasure at the moment. And so I think that there were a lot of things involved, but it felt like a good generic title, really.
And original Zombies member Chris White is back too. How did that occur?
I think it was almost a social thing, really. He just happened to be up at Rod's. I think he wanted to play us a song. He played us a song, which actually is great. It's an old demo from way back when. And we did actually think of including it on the album, but it didn't make it in the end. But while he was there, we said, well, it'd be great if you could do some harmonies with us. And it was lovely to hear him singing again. And I think there is something quite magical about our voices when we sing together. If you hear us separately, it doesn't sound so wonderful, but there's just something about when it...
Some of the parts,
yes,
yeah.
When it meshes together. I mean, I must just tell you how we used to get our harmonies together in the Zombies when we very first started. I mean, Rod is a very, very good harmony singer, and Chris and I are not particularly. Chris had to play the bass, so because he had to play the bass and sing at the same time, Rod would try and write him a harmony that was almost one note. And I never knew what a harmony was from a melody. So he would say to me, you sing what you think is the melody.
In so, his harmony section.
Yeah. In my harmony.
So it's not go up an octave, it's just do this.
No, exactly. Just do what you feel is natural.
What you're hearing.
Just
yeah.
Do what you feel is natural. So I would
it worked.
Sing, I would sing what I thought was the melody. Chris would sing a straight line, and then Rod would have to fill in all the holes. So his harmony would be something like la 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 da 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 da. And so that's why our harmonies sound so different.
Yes,
it's actually you know, just born out of our need to do it like that.
It worked.
It worked.
It did, yeah.
Two words. It worked.
Yeah.
Isn't that all that counts?
Well, I get a great kick when people will say to me now, you know, they've got a high singer and a low singer, and they say, we want to get those harmonies just how you did it. And I think, well, you ain't going to do it like that.
I can't explain it to you. I'm sorry. Okay, on to the songs. I think the reason, you know, I admitted that that I recently pulled out my old single of I Don't Believe in Miracles, not even knowing that this was coming, and played it on the air a while ago, just
wow.
Because it's just there. And I think I was 13 or 14, I'm dating, you know, myself, a little younger than you, but probably 13 or 14, because it was 1972.
Yes.
If I'm guessing correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it was 1972. So Russ Ballard, another member of Argent, wrote that one, so that the connections go even deeper between the two of you.
It's extraordinary, actually. And there are more connections than that, because the bass player in our band is actually my cousin, Jim Rodford, who was the original bass player in Argent, was the guy that lent the Zombies the gear for their very first rehearsal, and was the guy we actually originally asked to be in the Zombies, but he couldn't do that at the time. And his son, who's also obviously related to me, is the drummer in the band. So it's a family thing. There's connections all over the place.
You have to love it. It's the way it should be, though.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, isn't that...
So natural, yeah.
Rock and roll is either about dispute or about togetherness.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much...
Well, we go for togetherness, really.
Where we can.
And with regard to Russ Ballard, on my first two solo albums, although it wasn't planned that Argent would play on nearly all the tracks, because I knew them so well...
And it was the same label, at least here in the United States.
It was the same in the UK as well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Epic.
Yes.
So on my first two albums, most of the tracks that had a band on them, it was Argent. Because they were just the people I knew best. So it was quite natural that Russ wrote some tunes, Rod wrote some tunes, and Chris White wrote some tunes as well. So I was really fortunate to have three great writers working on the album.
Amazing. Time to Move, speaking of which. And you know, it's funny, you get the record, and you do want to go for the easiest thing to ease people in to the new
sure,
thing.
Sure.
Okay. There is, you're right, if we went back to your original sessions... Did it do the same for you as you were writing and recording it? Because it's phenomenal.
Well, let me tell you the story about this song. It was towards the end of the album, and this is yet another charity thing, but this was a really little low-key charity thing. It was a charity thing that Jim had set up in a little local hall in St Albans. He said, I've got loads of people coming down to play. Will you come down and play tonight? Just so happened that Colin couldn't make it that night, and it just so happened that the rest of our band happened to be there. And I thought, do you know what I'm going to do? This is not like me. I mean, I do write some songs very quickly. Other songs can take me a long time. But I thought, I'm going to write a song in the morning. I'm going to go out there, I'm going to write a rock and roll song, and we're going to play it tonight. So I went out that morning, I wrote it, lyrics, everything, the whole song, wrote it on a piece of paper, on a chord sheet, gave it to the guys that evening, and I sang it. And I said to the guys, we were on stage playing various things, old rock and roll things, whatever. And I said, can you play this, guys? It's in this sort of tempo. And we just played it, and it went down a storm. And that was the story of that song. It was written, and when we recorded it, apart from the lead vocal, because Colin never heard the tune, apart from me just singing it over to him, we recorded it completely from start to finish, apart from the lead vocal, all the harmonies and everything, in one afternoon, in about 4 hours. And then a few days later, Colin came back and put the lead voice on.
I fully expect. Now, the one time I've played it so far was a pre-recorded show, so I only got some emails.
All right.
But I fully expect people to call and say, now, which of the original albums is that on?
Right.
I fully expect that to happen. Because it's that it's that wonderful in a fabulous way. But now let's do a whole different thing, because obviously right at that moment I will be playing that song and we will have heard that. But in my mind, a miracle in the lyrics. In you, I found my odyssey and oracle. Lots of references and stories in the first person in the lyrics throughout the album. It's very, very first person.
Yeah.
Song written, song sung. And it's interesting because, of course, written by Rod, sung by Colin, but a lot of first person in the lyrics, really kind of intriguing to me.
Well, if I could just say about the Odyssey and Oracle thing, when Rod first played that song to us, often as these songs would be developing with Rod when we were on the road, and he would play them at soundcheck, you know, just before the show. And he said, well, I've got this rough lyric, and he sang Odyssey and Oracle. And we all thought that was great. We fell about, thought it was fantastic. And Rod said, well, I can't keep that in. It's too corny.
It's just tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah. But it was the band that forced him to keep that line in.
So you were saying too cheeky.
Well, it made me chuckle when I wrote it. I actually, the chorus from that song came to me when I was actually on holiday with my wife somewhere. And I got the whole chorus and the lyrics, and I chuckled. And I wrote it on the back of a piece of paper, and I wrote the tune on the back of a piece of paper as well. No piano there or anything. And when I got back, I sang it over, you know, to Colin. And I said, well, I can't use that, obviously. I said, but it just appeared. And they said, yeah, why not? You know, it's tongue-in-cheek.
Oh, you have to.
It's tongue-in-cheek.
Well, and we'll get to that album in a second. Yeah. But South Side of the Street, I didn't know till I read it yesterday, and then I listened to it on the way here this morning, that that's the single.
Now, in England, yeah.
In England. Now, would have been... What about here?
Do you know, I've actually no idea, Dennis.
But you didn't go for Time to Move. You didn't go for the obvious by any stretch, because South Side of the Street is a very different... It's a completely different feel from anything you've done before.
Yeah.
I think Rod very often goes for different things. A lot of producers...
I mean, it's wonderful, but it's not the obvious.
No, a lot of producers go for the same, you know, like, especially, for instance, it's not what you're asking, but if you've had a hit record, people will always want you to do nearly the same thing again.
Of course.
But Rod has always gone for different, and you were very much for South Side of the Street as a single, weren't you? Because it is different.
It's, I don't know, it was... Really, in the States here, if there's, I mean, I don't have the knowledge of all the radio formats and everything and what is possible to put out. But I mean, if the reaction were very good to that song, and if the record company said, look, we should go with this as a single, I'd have absolutely no problem with that at all.
No,
I'd be very happy.
It's a wonderfully, I don't want to say brave move, but it's a wonderfully original move. And people will hear it right now and they'll understand what I'm talking about. No synths. Hardly any overdubs, but a 21-piece orchestra. How organic, to use that word we overuse here in the States, and old-fashioned.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
It's rock and roll, as in rock and roll.
But that was the idea right from the beginning, I think, to put my voice with strings. I mean, it's not old-fashioned because we don't know how to do modern recording.
Obviously.
But we just had that idea. Mostly Rod. Rod produced the album, so I mean...
Well, I mean, the thing was that I've always The first time I really heard Connie's voice with strings was on an album I also produced with Chris White, the One Year album, from which he had some big hits in Europe. Say You Don't Mind was a very big hit. And I just adored his voice with strings. And then later on, of course, he did the Alan Parsons projects with a friend of ours, Andrew Powell, did the string arrangements. Wonderfully, wonderful string arranger. And there was a track called Olden Wires, which in Europe has become a very big track indeed. And Connie's voice with strings, and I loved it. And at the beginning of this album, I said, why don't we renew that relationship with your voice with strings? And so that was a conscious decision. But as you said, very organic, because we wanted to go out without overdubs. We wanted to use what was exciting as the band as it was on stage. And we thought, we're going to record an album like that. Now, people hardly ever do that these days. But we thought, we just want to do it like that, in a very organic way, no synths, and with strings. And also, I love writing for strings. And I think one of the reasons is because I'm self-taught. I've got friends who, you know, have come up through music college and everything. And if they do a string arrangement, they do it as a piece of work and they say, yeah, fine. To me, if I hear a string section actually playing what I've written and it actually works in the studio, I get very excited because, you know.
Very surprised.
Yeah, very surprised. Yeah.
That's pretty ambitious. 21 pieces and no music background per se.
Yeah.
Okay, this is probably too deep of a musicology question, but my listeners are, you know, they actually pay attention to these things. So let's see if we can do this math equation. I have this theory that there are three different types of Zombies fans. Those who grew up with She's Not There. Those who discovered you through Time of the Season, which of course was released as a single after Odyssey and Oracle. And then those who went back and went to the depth of Odyssey and Oracle.
Very perceptive, exactly.
What do you think? And yet there's this, which I will venture to say would satisfy all three.
Well, I'm
of those of
well,
those.
Maybe there's going to be a fourth category. You know, people who will discover us through this new album,
and go back,
or maybe even discover us through us playing live, because we do get very, very good responses when we play live. So maybe there's going to. I think you're right about the three categories.
It's kind of. I don't know very many bands. I don't know very many bands that you could turn around and say that their career is the result of, you know, a huge couple of top 40 hits, an album that came out and truthfully wasn't noticed to any great extent, but then
absolutely
was circled
not
back due to this.
It's quite extraordinary.
Huge single.
But it's quite extraordinary. I mean, Odyssey and Oracle came out, and even with a number one single, because in Cashbox that was number one.
Yes.
And in Billboard it made number three or something, but they were the two equivalent magazines at the time. Even with a number one single, it only reached sort of, you know, just into the 100 in the charts, and really wasn't noticed by anyone. You're absolutely right. 15 years later, for some odd reason, that record started to pick up momentum. And now, year in, year out, around the world, we get substantial sales on Odyssey and Oracle.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Absolutely.
But why? We don't know.
Because it's become a cult.
Yeah, it has, actually.
Item.
Yeah.
It's just one of those, like the White Album,
Or
that's just become kind of, people are digging deeper and deeper into it to find what you hid in there.
And a couple of months ago, Rolling Stone voted for the top 500 albums of all time. And we made about number 80. And we chuckled because that's higher than it got the first time round with a number one single, you know,
all
these years later.
But also another thing we've been doing, we've been thinking about doing a show where we play the whole of Odyssey and Oracle.
Wouldn't that be wild? With Brian Wilson going out there now and playing all of Smile.
Yes.
I think people might, and he's doing it here at Davies Symphony Hall. So it could become a, you know, not even a rock and roll experience, but more of a classical kind of innovative sort of, you know, I think people would.
Well,
would
we're thinking about it really seriously. And one of the things that we did, we decided we need to just sit down around the piano, just Rod and I. We haven't played these songs in
such
years.
A long time.
Yeah.
Not since we recorded them.
No, some of them. And so we just, in the last couple of weeks, we've just been going through them. And they sound really good. So we got a very pleasant surprise. They sound great. And I think it's really going to work.
Absolutely. And if we did it, I think we'd do it as a period piece, and we would try and get absolutely as close to, you know, to the detail of what was going on. I would have to get a second, you know, strangely enough, there's more layering on Odyssey and Oracle than there is on this new album.
You might have to resort to a little bit of something there to make it truly authentic.
A second keyboard player.
I'd have a second keyboard player to play the mellotron parts, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, really.
You've said two words that make me smile now. You've said Cashbox, which is the word nobody, half of this audience would be like, what's that?
Yeah.
And now you've said mellotron.
Yes.
It's like you and the Moody Blues.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well,
wonderful stuff.
It was, you know, it was a revelation at the time.
Yes,
you know,
indeed.
No synths or anything. And
way before the Fairlight or any of these.
And it was a swine to, on stage. It would go out of tune all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was just, each note had a loop on a cassette, basically.
Right.
And, you know, you can imagine the deterioration in quality. And, oh, God, it was going wrong all the time.
Mentioned Cashbox because She's Not There and Time of the Season were both number one in Cashbox. And at the time, Cashbox was an equivalent to Billboard.
Yes, it was.
But we never got to number one in Billboard, so we always talk about Cashbox.
Exactly. Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, the reason Cashbox, for those who will not care about this discussion whatsoever, but it doesn't, I say so many things on my show that people don't care about, then they go back afterwards, oh, I discovered that. Cashbox was named Cashbox because it was the magazine that was based on the jukeboxes originally.
Really?
Right. As in the Cashbox in the jukebox, which in the end, as we all know, anybody who's out there is going to give me real trouble, but the mafia, of course, controlled all the jukeboxes pretty much in America. And
right.
I think that having a song on the radio was one thing because you made some of your royalties off of ASCAP or whatever it was. But having a record on the jukebox was physical money being put in a cash box. And in the end, you know, America heard things in two places, but jukeboxes back then were huge.
Yeah.
Mm, yeah.
So at least this is my sense. I'm going to have to go back and see if I'm accurate in any way, wow. shape, or form, but just really interesting. I'll bet few people know that Odyssey and Oracle never really did much in England, and if it weren't for Al Kooper, it wouldn't have even been released here in the United States. Is that a true story? Did I read correctly on that?
That's absolutely true. He came to London and he went back to America with a stack of, you know, 40 or 50 albums, maybe more, many albums. And he just thought that Odyssey and Oracle shone out from that great bunch of albums. And he forced CBS to release the album. It wouldn't have been released without him.
He was the hottest producer in America at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was doing quite a bit of things. Well, amazing story. Okay. I say this with politeness, but you're in a world of indie bands, and you it's not that you cheated, but you did this at Air Studios.
It at Air Studios.
Right. Recorded it in my studio at home.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Apart from the strings.
Well, I was going to say, you still had 21 piece orchestra in Air Studios, so you did this the big old fashioned way to a great.
Yeah, we tried to do that. We really did.
Well,
try
it
and do
sounds
that.
It. I mean, the sound is just phenomenal.
Oh, thank you.
But I mean, are you thinking that the combination of what you did, you recorded in your studio at home, I'm sure your studio at home is not what the average indie band is working with. I'm sure you've got something pretty...
Well, it's set up just for us. I mean, the cost of recording really well now has come down immensely from what it was.
Indeed.
But in fact, I mean, I started producing albums for other artists seriously at the end of the 80s. And in Europe, for instance, an album that I recorded with my colleague, Peter Van Hook, who started out being the drummer with Van Morrison, but he's a wonderful musician and has played with many people. But we started producing artists. The first artist we produced was Tanita Tikaram. Mm-hmm. And I upgraded my studio to professional quality at that point. And that first Tanita Tikaram album called Ancient Heart in Europe sold 4.5 million albums.
Wow.
And we then did, for 10, 12 years, I did nothing but produce other artists, including Nancy Griffith in America. Mm-hmm. I did Late Night Grand Hotel, one of her albums. Mm-hmm. And everything was recorded at my studio. But I see, but we've now upgraded to digital stuff, and the actual cost of really fine stuff has come down so much now.
Yes,
and so I think many people could come close to what I've got, although I do have a few little things like old... what you call tube microphones here, we call them valve.
Mm-hmm.
Like U47s from that were made in the 60s.
No, you can hear that sound.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the difference, is a lot of the home recorded records, I call it the tinny factor.
Sure.
You know, the warmth, I mean, you know, to have a voice like yours and not recorded that way, the way it would be recorded today would sound very, very different.
Yeah.
To say the least. Popular. I went on a website just for the fun of it, which is allmusic.com, which is the popular music website. And I want to read you the description of the Zombies, because I wonder if you ever got to read this. It says, aside from the Beatles and perhaps the Beach Boys, no mid-60s pop group wrote melodies as gorgeous as those of the Zombies. So aside from the mid-60s qualifier, do you think that the reason for a comeback is that, and this is what my show specializes in, a lot of melodic rock you know, there's Keen and the delays and the veils. You know, there's a lot of melodic rock.
I like Keen, yeah.
That's getting a lot of airplay these days. Mm. And that this fits.
It does.
Very snugly into what all of the new, you know, groovy bands,
I'm
particularly
really
from
glad
England,
you can hear that. It's wonderful that you can hear that, actually, because so many people are conditioned. I know I don't want to go over old ground. We've already spoken about this. But so many people are conditioned by category that they don't have ears, they don't listen. And I was saying to Colin on the way over, it's bizarre. I said, have you heard Keane's stuff? I've just bought the new album to play.
We had an interview with them on my show that ran yesterday.
Yeah. And I said, because our stuff, really, you know, it fits exactly
like
with what they're doing.
Like a glove.
And yet people, I said, you know, I can't believe that people don't see this. You know?
But now, so that's going to be the trick. I mean, I can do it, obviously. I can help. But it's going to be the trick of the record company.
Yeah.
To package it.
Yeah.
And say, okay, if you're playing Keen and you're playing, you know, the delays,
yeah,
you know, put everything aside that you remember about the Zombies.
That's what they have to do.
Because that's not what, I mean, it is
what
it is.
Hard for people to do that.
Indeed it is, but I to put it in a great perspective, to me it makes, you know, it makes perfect sense.
Well, I'm so excited that you hear it and you see it.
No, it was obvious. They also, the same website says, and I love this, that the unexpected shift from major to minor keys was perhaps too adventurous for the singles market at the time. Do you think that what's perhaps different in this do-it-yourself era of recording is that many a rock musician doesn't really... Now, you mentioned, and I wrote this question way before you told me, that you don't have a classical music education, that you're taking singing lessons, but yet you chose... I don't think that you chose to write from major to minor keys for the purpose of A, having trouble in the singles market, or B, lack of knowledge of music. You did it from your soul. You did it because it sounded right. And, you know, I love that they said it was too adventurous for the singles market. I'm not sure what they meant there, because it certainly didn't hurt you in maybe the later singles that didn't reach the top. You know,
do you know, the way I always think about it is that, certainly personally, I can only write one way, and that is to find an idea that excites me and then to follow it through and try and make it work. End of story. Because I always think if you can capture something on record that excites you when you're recording it, and that's easier said than done, then you stand some chance of being able to reach out and touch somebody else. And in the end, that is the most commercial thing you can ever do. If you can touch somebody, then they'll go out and buy your record. And I mean, we always say, think about the Beatles. I mean, they never thought, how can we write a good hook here? They thought, they were just excited by music, and they just wrote what excited them.
Exactly.
And that's how we both approach this whole thing now. And that's how this came into being, really, Colin, wasn't it?
Well, absolutely, yeah.
Colin, talk about the difficulty of singing. I'll read it again because I love saying it. Singing unexpected shifts from major to minor keys. Whoa! Oh, there's a major key. Oh, there's a minor.
Piece of cake.
Well,
yeah. But so, I love it. So,
sometimes singing Rod songs can be quite challenging, I have to be honest. The melody sometimes is not quite what you think it is if you listen to it very quickly. And we do work on phrasing for long periods of time, possibly more when we were younger. I think it's a little bit easier now. But we are very conscious of the phrasing. We put a lot of work into a vocal. And I'm always very pleased when people say to me, that sounds so effortless.
That's what you've got to capture, though.
That sounds like you just walked in and did it.
You know, and no matter what's behind it, it has to sound
but
fresh
and effortless. We put quite a lot of work into it. And then hopefully it does sound effortless. The other thing is, as Rod said earlier on, he likes to hear me singing at the top of my range, which again can be a little bit challenging, because you can, you know, you get it in the studio, it's fine. And 4 weeks out on the road and you're still trying to get those top A's and B's and whatnot. And you can start to curse the writer a bit that he made you write, he made you sing in this key. But no, I would say that some of Rod's songs are quite challenging, but they're also very rewarding.
Well, why I think this is, you know, obviously it's going to work. You know, when I think about doing my show, and it's the same thing about making it sound effortless, I spend an immense amount of time picking the songs I'm going to play to put together. And everybody's like, well, how did that come together so well? And I say, well, okay, been at it a while, so you know how to write songs. But it's not, nothing is effortless.
No.
Nothing that it, but it is that instinct of knowing what a hit is.
Yeah.
And at least I've been written up, and I know you certainly have too. There's nothing wrong with having hits. It's perfectly okay.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all these bands that are out there to say, well, you know, we don't really want a hit record. We just want to play on the road and be poor.
Well, we've never really felt care. That. We never try to be poor.
We don't really feel, you know, we don't feel the need to sell a million records. Oh my goodness, let's just be as radical as we can be. And I've always operated on the.
But that's contrived. If you do that, that's not following your
it's
heart.
It's exact
is it?
Opposite.
Yeah,
exact opposite. So, if my research is correct, the two of you were born 10 days from each other. 1 year short of 60 years ago.
And actually, Rod is older than me. Do you mind if I just
By
that
10
out?
Days.
10 days.
By 10 days, if I did my research correctly.
You did.
So obviously not too old to rock and roll and to tour family aside. So once it's in your blood, it's kind of hard to get out. I mean, you were 16 when you started, right?
Yeah.
Around there, yeah.
Around there.
As we said earlier, it feels exactly the same when we're on stage.
I mean, here, I've got two 60-year-old rock and rollers in my studio. I'm 47. We're a bunch of old farts here.
I know.
And everybody's listening funny. Saying, what are these people? What are they talking about?
When you say there's two 60-year-old rock musicians in the studio, I find myself looking over my shoulder because I'm not quite sure who you're talking about. And it's
Doesn't
weird.
Doesn't that blow you away, though?
Yeah, I know. It is extraordinary, actually. I mean, I haven't minded getting older generally, but the thought of next year being 60, I mean, I can't take that on board at all. But I have to say that, you know, the parts of touring which are tedious are as tedious as they ever were.
Well, they always will be.
And they're extremely tiring.
And that's probably the travelling is their main thing, isn't
it? But they were extremely tiring when we were 18 as well, you know. But, I mean, that's part of it you can't get out of. And we don't enjoy that. And it is hard being away from our families, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that really is hard. When you're 18, it's great. It's just a big adventure. And that is really hard. But the actual bit about being on stage and getting reaction from audiences and being energised in that way is fantastic. And it's a privilege to be able to do that.
Tell me about Paul Atkinson, the original Zombies guitarist, and the benefit you did for him.
Well, Paul had been ill for a long, long time, probably 10 years. It was just one thing after another. And in the end, it was probably about 9 months ago, a year ago, he was diagnosed with cancer. And he was very, very brave. He kept working. He kept smiling. He kept being positive. And he had many friends in the record industry because he'd made that transition. He'd been a successful rock guitarist, but he'd been a very successful record executive as well. And I think he knew he was coming towards the end of his life. And some of his friends decided to put a benefit concert together for him at the House of Blues on Sunset Strip in Los Angeles. And we were asked, all the original Zombies were asked to come over and play, and we did. And Brian Wilson played. And some guys from Mr. Mister, many artists turned up, and it was a wonderful evening. Of course, it was tinged with sadness. It was great for us to get up on stage together, the original lineup, and Paul played with us as well.
Sitting down, he was attached to his tubes and everything, but fantastic.
Incredible.
But, you know, he was obviously very ill, and it was a very moving experience. And I have to say that later on, Brian Wilson played after us, because Paul wanted to play early, and he went home, because he wasn't that strong. But Brian Wilson was playing later on, and I found myself right at the back. I love the Beach Boys. I was right at the back. It was very dark. There was no one with me, and he started playing Don't Worry, Baby.
Which he had asked Paul, hadn't he, to give him a request. Is there anything you specifically want me to do? And that's why I did Don't Worry, Baby.
Yeah, and I felt this tears just streaming down my face. It was a very emotional evening, but I'm so glad that we were able to come over
Absolutely.
And do it.
I mean, we started out with him. You know, we were 16 years old when we started playing, and when Paul was there at that first rehearsal.
Of course.
And here we were all these years later, and it was the closure of something, you know.
Yes, and I think it was about 8 weeks later that he died.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, that's a lovely thing that you did. You know, I have to tell you, as a vocalist, my wife wanted to go see the Beach Boys, and we did this about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I told this story on my show. I forewarned her what she was in for. And we got there. They had, my favorite thing is that they had a musical director that, you know, someone was introduced as the musical director.
The horn player.
Yeah.
You're talking about Brian Wilson.
I'm talking touring as the Beach Boys. With Mike Love.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'm sorry.
It took 12 men on stage to try to approximate what they, and Mike Love was there, you know, so his vocals were relevant. But the gentleman who was trying, and I underline trying, to be Brian Wilson, who had a lovely voice. It just goes to show you that in rock and roll, everybody puts, you know, the guitar and the drums and all of that. But in terms of vocals, my wife just turned to me and said, you know, well, when Mike Love sang certain songs, it sounded like Mike Love. But when the Brian Wilson parts came in, it was absolutely sad to hear.
Right.
So the importance of what you two have chosen to do and the care and the loving that you've put into, you know, strings sound good with Colin's voice, writing lyrics to test your range, you taking vocal lessons. This is, you know, for rock and roll, this is pretty... pretty awesome, an awesome level of care and danger at the same time to make it happen.
But it's rewarding to us, you see, to do that.
Well, no, but
it's
I think
a really
the biggest
rewarding experience.
I think you did it for two things. I think you did it for you because you felt it, and you wanted to do it. And you both look so, you know, it's not television, but you look so joyful, you know, sitting here that you get to do it, and the passion is there, and you don't see a lot of that.
No.
Not anymore, and it shows in the music. And we're not going to get into any sort of discussion these days about, you know, what's good or what's bad. Mm-hmm. It's more we all know what's good, and we know that it's still capable. I think the moral to all of this is that it's still capable of happening.
Oh, well, thank you very
much. That it can happen. So the last question that I always officially ask, and this is kind of really fun, I always ask people to make a sandwich with their music, and you're the bread, so you can pick... you know, a couple of Zombies tunes. And then you can put, and what we do is we put together the set afterwards. What would you like to hear musically? And it could be anywhere or anything, and you both can pick a few. What would you like, if I play a couple of tunes from here, and this is the bread, what would you like in the middle of the sandwich? What would you like for the fillings?
Well, you were going to...
I'm going to... In the interview, we're going to play a few tracks. Right.
Okay. And you're asking us to pick the bread...
I'm asking you to pick a couple of other things that you'd like.
From the Zombies before?
Well, or new or old, and then pick some things in the middle. Musically, it could be from any band, anybody you've always wanted to hear with your music, and then I'll put it together. And I tend to send it to people, and they say, you really did play so-and-so next to so-and-so, and I say, yes, I have the freedom, and it's really kind of fun. Colin's already thinking, like, what would I like to hear next to my voice?
I don't think I want to hear anything too good. That's the thing.
I'll tell you what you can hear next to Colin's voice. Now, this is, I know I'm immediately veering off what you've just said.
Oh, go ahead.
But on the new Quentin Tarantino film, Kill Bill 2, there's a seminal scene. I haven't seen it, but I've heard the record. And Malcolm McLaren puts Bessie Smith's voice beside Collins, and what they've done, they've taken Bessie Smith singing St. Louis Blues, and it's great because she sort of sings "My Man," all this sort of happens, and then it cuts to the original Zombies version of "She's Not There," but slowed down, but in the original pitch, because you can do that now, you can time stretch things, and with the original pitch. And you get Collins singing it really slowed down. The original pitch, "No One Told Me About Her," goes back to Bessie Smith again. And it gives me a great thrill to hear Bessie Smith beside Colin. So that's one thing.
Absolutely. I can play that track.
That sounds very cool. But go on, Colin, you choose something.
What have you always wanted to kind of play next to some, you know, do you want any of the old Zombies tunes to be played as part of this interview?
If you want to, yeah.
What would be your choice of a track or two that might either surprise people or...
Well, I'll give you one that would surprise people. I would choose a Chris White song, "Butcher's Tale" from Odyssey and Oracle.
Okay. "I Remember When I Loved Her."
Oh, that's a good one.
A very early. I'm trying to think of early tunes. I thought
from the first album.
Yeah, that was a really good one.
Which was which we later learned was a huge hit in Australia. We didn't know for years.
It's one of the things we never realised. You know, when we were originally in the band, we never knew that we were having hits all around the world. Mm-hmm. No one told us, and it was
a shame.
I know, it was only years later. Perhaps the band would have kept going if we'd known that we were having hits, but we didn't know. You going to pick one? Are we still on old ones?
Are we still on old ones?
Well, old ones or anything new or other old, you know, something you've always wanted to hear next to, next to some of your tunes.
I'll tell you my favorite song.
There you go.
Is "Fragile" by Sting.
Wow.
Which I think is the most gorgeous song. I can't picture what it would be like played alongside our stuff.
We'll find out.
But I'd like to hear it anyway.
I'll give you a couple of very different things. I'll give you three incredibly different things here, right? This is just off the top of my head. One is The Thrills from an album last year called So Much for the City.
We had them right there.
And the reason I'm picking this is because I loved that album, and I took it on the road. I took three albums on the road with me on the last tour that we did last year. One was a Keith Jarrett album called Still Live, and an album of standards played live, which I love. Another one actually was a piece of Bach, and the other one was The Thrills, So Much for the City, and then just after that, I was so knocked out because on the radio in England, they chose Time of the Season as one of their seminal records.
Wow!
And I was so pleased that because there are many young bands, which this is another thing, which is so nice. There are many young bands that cite us as an influence. I can't usually hear it at all, you know, when I hear it. So I'm going to choose Big Sir, You're Not That Far. Because of that, it gave me a lot of pleasure.
I could see that working together.
I'm going to choose something which would be very different. I've got a feeling that this band might have said they liked us as well, but I'm not sure. It's Radiohead, Paranoid Android.
Okay.
And I'm going to go back to an early Elvis thing. The first time I heard Elvis was when I heard Hound Dog, and it spun my world around. It changed my life, really. And many years later on, in the 90s, we found out that Elvis had our songs on his jukebox, which just completely blew me away. It absolutely blew me away. And in fact, we'd gone up to meet him, and his father had shown us around the place. But Elvis was away filming at the time. This was in 1965. We just knocked on his door and said, "Is Elvis in?" Vernon
sounds
came to the
bizarre,
door.
But it's true.
Quite extraordinary. And we thought that he'd never heard of us, and he was just being very hospitable. But we found out years later he had our song. So I'm going to choose not Hound Dog, but it could be one of two other things which knocked me out totally at the time. One was That's All Right, Mama, but I'm going to choose Lordy Miss Claudie.
Oh, there you go.
There you are. There's three very different songs.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much. This has just been absolutely lovely.
For and us
it's just I can't
yes,
wait.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see you tomorrow night.
Thank you.
That's going to be exciting stuff. Thank you so much, Rod and Colin.
Pleasure.
So the next thing I'm going to have you do.